you know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. My first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, and my second feature has just been written. It's done. It's yes! Beginning, middle, and end. That thing. How are you, Liz?
Congratulations. Thank you. I'm okay, but my name is Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in pre-production on my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and a distribution consultant, and I used to manage the Creative Distribution Initiative at Sundance.
This week, we welcome writer, director, and friend of the show, Nathan Blackwell, to talk about writing and directing his latest feature, The Last Movie Ever Made, which is delightful, by the way, which he made on a shoestring budget in a small Arizona town. After that, we play another round of Y'all the Expert. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
I was having a panic attack trying to figure out how to answer this question. I'm doing fine. I think I just... I've run out of time to do all the things that I need to do in life. I don't know how to raise two children, work my part-time job, and be in pre-production on a movie. I don't know. I don't know why I signed myself up for this. I don't know why I don't see it as a viable option to stop doing one of those things. Well, I mean, what would I stop doing? What of those things? Stop making the movie? No, I'm going to do all of these things. So I'm just a very strapped for time, but I'm refusing to rush myself. Does that make sense? It's like, maybe I could get everything done in a day that I need to if I really just went cuckoo crazy and just super fast and like a whirlwind of productivity. But I'm not interested in doing that. So I'm just going to be at a deficiency for the rest of my life. That is how I feel. How are you?
I'm good. I also feel that thing. Yeah. As a parent of two children, you know, one of which is the same exact age as your child. So I know that feeling. I do think that our lives are going to get better in about 6 months from now, 5 to 6 months. I think life will be better.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to time traveling to that time where life is better. Whenever that was in that 6 months. But yeah, no, things are good. I finished the script, which is extremely exciting. And I've been toiling around with the log line and because I have to tell it to people. And what I've been telling people before was this movie is insane. It's got mad scientists. It's got aliens. It's got this and that. And people are they don't know how to react to that. And it's doesn't make any sense. So I actually practiced what the log line really is, and to some success, and to the point where I told it to Beth and she was like, I want to read this script. And she's hasn't wanted to read anything I've done in a long time. So that was kind of cool that she was interested. So that's cool. I kind of want to do the log line right now, but I kind of don't want to do the log line right now, but I feel like I should do the log line as a member of this, the show, and in my spirit of sharing with everyone of what, you
just
know,
do
as
it.
A filmmaker.
Just so, do yeah. it now. Yeah.
The movie's about a couple who get caught up in a chase for a serum that potentially will blow up the city and could severely harm the planet. So a couple on the verge of a breakup get caught up in a chase, an intergalactic chase for a serum that could have grave consequences on the well-being of the planet Earth. And their lives are forever changed in the process.
Yeah.
That's roughly what I got so far.
I love the use of the word intergalactic. I don't know why, but for some reason I was like, ooh, you've got me now. As soon as you said intergalactic.
It is intergalactic. I mean, it's only really takes place on Earth, but there are intergalactic forces at play. So that's kind of fun.
However you're stretching the truth, it's working for me. I appreciate it.
There will be aliens and multiple species of aliens in this movie. So I feel like it's fair to say intergalactic.
Yeah.
Which is cool. So yeah, I'm very excited. I've started rewriting. So I've gone back to the beginning and started because it's the way the movie is written. It's not linear. It's completely out of order, the whole movie. Mm-hmm. And so I had written things in the beginning and then I, finished the movie. And so then by finishing the movie, things that I wrote in the beginning had to change in order for it to make sense. So I'm just going through and changing those things so that they make sense. And that what the characters are saying in the first scene, which is actually the climax of the movie, connect, So yeah, so it's good. So far, it's actually been pretty fast. I only spent probably like maybe 30 minutes or so, or maybe an hour rewriting, and I'm already on page 12. So
nice.
I thought that was pretty good, and I got to keep doing that. And then once I've rewritten that, I'm going to send it off to a few people. There's a couple of people I just met like recently who don't know me at all. Some who don't even know this podcast at all, who are going to read the script. And I think that's going to be really helpful for like complete strangers to me to read the script, because those kinds of insights from like writers and filmmakers who, you know, have similar interests, but like don't know who I am. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be really interesting. And like men and women, you know, so
yeah,
I'm excited. I had another meeting with someone, a listener of the show, Sarah. It's a really interesting spelling. I love it. Anyway, she was great. She's making a sci-fi, or it's like, someone's called a sci-fi. It's like a horror magical realism short film. It's really kind of up your alley, Liz.
Oh, cool.
And she's never done anything like this before. She's never done any like creature stuff. And so she was picking my brain on how to do it. It's an attempt to make, it would be like a proof of concept for a feature. And so we were discussing all the merits of like, should she even make that movie? Should she just save the money for the feature? What's the point? Blah, blah, blah. It was a really fun conversation. I got the script now, so I'm going to read that and give her my thoughts on that one.
Nice.
So yeah, I feel like it's been a very busy filmmaking week for me. Like I feel like a lot of things have been happening in my filmmaking world, which has been cool. But yeah, good stuff. You know what else is good stuff? Patreon. Go to our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. This is the way the show will survive. We do have ads on the show now, but plot twist, we get paid quarterly for those. Second plot twist, our numbers are way down because of stupid Apple and the way that they changed their algorithm. So that plan of making the show self-sustainable is not panning out so well so far. So this Patreon is really the way that we pay our editor. So, you know, thank you all for everyone who supports the show on Patreon. It really makes a big difference. I know every week we say we're going to think of ways to sweeten the deal, sweeten the pot for our patrons. We will figure that out one day. But also make sure to review the show. The ratings and the reviews really help, you know, us get more listeners and spread the word on the show. Another plot twist, apparently people leave reviews and then they don't get populated. So for reviews to actually work, apparently you have to leave them like two or three times. So there may be many people who've left reviews and we have not seen them.
Aww.
So I don't know. Ratings are good too. So if you just leave a rating, hopefully those populate and those will count to our ticker on Apple Podcasts. But after all that cheery news, without further delay, here's our chat with the wonderful Nathan Blackwell. Well, we're here with Nathan Blackwell. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, longtime listener, first-time caller.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Nathan's been like involved with the podcast for many, many years. I think we've read questions and things and emails, and you've been a Patreon supporter, and yeah, just a really, really great guy. So Nathan, thanks for coming on the show, and so excited to be here for your first, talk about your first, this is your first feature, right?
No!
Well, there's a story behind Ulrich. It, so that's a good angle.
It's, boo! Ulrich needs to do more research.
Right. No, that's okay. In a lot of ways, this is kind of, it feels like my first movie.
It's amazing. Okay, well, can't wait to dig into that. But for now, just give us the elevator pitch for the last movie ever made.
So the last movie ever made, it's a comedy with, I would kind of categorize it in the dramedy zone. You know, I'm kind of addicted to that happy, sad feeling, you know. But the story itself is when our main character, Marshall, who's kind of pushing 40, hasn't done a lot with his life, when he finds out that the whole world is coming to an end, he decides that the big thing that he's going to do to kind of go out and to give his life some meaning is to finally finish his abandoned sci-fi movie from high school. So he has to kind of round up friends that he hasn't kept in contact with, and also is his ex-wife, who he's kind of been estranged from for about 10 years. And so it's kind of that mix of, you know, reckless idiots move forward in a situation doing something silly, like making a movie, making a sci-fi movie in the face of inevitable death.
That's a really good concept. All right. How many days did you shoot?
So the plan was 18 days, but it ended up being 16 days because of COVID. But yeah, it ended up being 16 days and 2 days of pickup shooting, where it was just kind of like inserts and things like that. We also, one of the pickup days was us shooting some of their old childhood short films. And so we plugged those in. So that was fun. But yeah, we originally, because everyone, you know, all of our actors are, they have a day job. And so we split production in half. The idea is that we were going to do, you know, like 8 days in November, and then we were going to do like eight to 10 days in January. But that January was when Omicron hit, and 2 days before they were supposed to fly to Phoenix, you know, our two main leads live in Minnesota. They got Omicron. And so,
wow.
So we then had to take what was going to be two halves of our production and turned it into three sections, just to make everyone's schedule work, because we had a number of wonderful crew members who get paid way more money than we could give them. And so they were kind of doing, you know, they wanted to do something fun and silly, and we had worked with them before, but they get paid 10 times as much normally. And so our 18 days got squished into 16 days to kind of finish it up.
Was it 5-5-6 or for your three different shoots, or how
it was? It was 8-6-2. And so it was basically divided in half by locations. So half the movie takes place, or at least 8 days of our shoot took place in one location, which was the house where they're filming the movie. So that was my mom's house. That was the only house we could get for all that time. And yeah, it was not without its problems. And then everything else was locations, to where we're in other locations like every single day, or maybe at most in one location for 2 days.
And what was the rough budget of the shoot, if you can say, or the whole
yeah,
movie?
So I probably will get struck down with lightning if I say the exact number.
Oh, no, you won't. Yay!
But it's very much close to your guys. So I'm familiar with your guys'.
I missed it.
Ulrich!
Nice. There you go. It's amazing. It's
to listeners, we get to see a piece of paper with a number on it, but we won't see it unless Nathan says it. So
it's definitely a micro budget in the same zone as like The Alternate and Bread and Butter, to where we just didn't have much money to pay people. What we did was is that we did something called Favored Nations. So everyone got paid the same amount. So everyone basically got $100 a day. Ooh. And then a lot of the department heads actually have that $100 a day deferred.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So really... Really, it was just a lot of the people who got paid were the people who were do this, you know, it's like it's their craft. And so like the camera crew, art department, they got paid the full amount, the makeup and things like that. And then the deferred thing was volunteer basis, you know. The actors are pretty much all the actors are half cash, half deferred. So yeah.
Are they non-union, not SAG, just to clarify?
Non-union, correct. Yeah.
What was the origin of the idea?
So I've tried a number of times to write something what I thought was going to be like a micro budget script. And so this is, I've had three previous scripts beforehand kind of leading up. It's like, oh no, it's just 100 zombies. Like we've done like 10 zombies. Like, you know, it's going to be 10 times as long as our short film. So that's doable. And it took a while till I finally had a script that I felt like it was about, that it was doable in kind of a reality sense. You know, my problem is I'm always looking for something fantastic or magical that kind of like makes normal people's lives more interesting in a certain way. It's kind of like, you know, it's either like strange things happening to normal people or normal things happening to strange people, you know. But yeah, it took a while to get there. Like I said, I've done, this is technically my third. I mean, it literally is my third feature. But in a lot of ways, the other ones were so long ago, you know, like the first one I did was, I was a baby right out of film school when I was 22. This is in 1998. I was very much inspired by Clerks and El Mariachi, and like, just run out there and do a camera, and then Sundance is going to be there, and your career is going to start. And And so we made like a $50,000 feature film on that was like a coming of age story, you know, and, you know, it didn't get distributed. We were very much like artists first. And it's like, oh, if we build it, it will come, you know, and we didn't have the business mind then. And it, you know, and that as like a 22-year-old who's kind of riding high on the dream of filmmaking, like that was a serious blow to one's own motivation. Cause really you're only propelled by, you know, your own, you know, like wild abandon and sort of ambition and dreams that are slightly disconnected from reality. And, you know, that slowed my roll a lot. You know, it made me second guess some of the things that I wanted to do. And yeah, my biggest regret was not getting back on the horse. You know,
but you did. It only took you like 8 years to make your next one.
It's two. Yeah. So it, you know, there was probably so from between 1998 or 99, kind of when it was done. And between like 2005, I was writing. But for those like 6 years, I kind of put down the film camera. You know, it was, you know, I was writing, but I wasn't really shooting anything. And it took a lot of energy to do another feature film. And this one was very much like, this is when the DVX 100 came out. And it's like, great, we're going to we can shoot 24p. And so we shot like a $4,000 feature, really just for ourselves. But that was kind of the beginning of the second chapter of my filmmaking career, of kind of like realizing why I do this, why I love it, the connection with the characters and the storytelling. But it took a long time to kind of it's like I think of like filmmaking and things like that. It's kind of like being like an athlete to a certain degree, even though I know nothing about sports. So I'm just assuming it's like being out of I was out of shape, you know, like it's like filmmaking is a marathon. And it took me years to get back into shape to where I just had the creative motivation and I was able to bring other crew members together. And just honestly, the motivation is a huge thing, because doing like a feature or a big ambitious project is such a leap of faith.
I feel like I'm going off the rails, Ulrich. I know we have other like required questions, but I want to tap into this because maybe you know this because I'm very predictable, but I really am interested in like disappointment and shame and rejection. Like they're like my favorite topics.
Let's do it.
So that first film, not getting distribution, did you rewatch the film? Did you feel, were you proud of it, or did you start to see it as a failure? Like, how did you view the film and your own talent because of that experience?
Yeah. So my first film was called Forever Midnight, and it was kind of a coming of age story, very much kind of like in the vein of My So-Called Life or something like that, where like three friends. It's actually kind of like a bit of American Graffiti, where three friends following their separate storylines as they have just graduated. And it's all during that summer where they've just graduated and they're trying to figure out what they want to do. I felt creatively like it was successful in what it attempted to do, but it was very much one of those kind of dramas to where it was more of a character piece and a little less entertainment, honestly.
Which is fine. Yeah. I'm trying to tap into like that question of finding motivation again. And it's like,
right,
I have been in a place myself, and I don't know if Ulrich has felt this way, where you just feel like, am I bad? Am I bad at this? Like, should I not do this because I'm bad? Like, is it that, or is it, it sounds like it wasn't that, which is good. Like, I'm glad that you didn't doubt your own talent.
Well, there definitely was. I would say I definitely did, because especially when you're young, it's so easy to put your entire self-worth on something like this, you know? Especially when you're in college or in your early 20s, you know, you think at this point, like, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't have proof, but I kind of feel like I might be the next Spielberg. There may be, you know, I would never like say something like that and, you know, or act like that. But there's a part of you that kind of feels like, you know, like, you know,
I'm the voice of my generation. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Especially when you grow up on these fairy tales about like some of these filmmakers who get to ride the golden elevator, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, even though you may be super rational and you tell everyone about how hard it is, there is that one little nugget inside you. Maybe I'm the exception. Oh, that'd be so cool. Yeah. And when I didn't have really a plan B as a young person. And so it was definitely kind of like a cracking of my reality of what I thought was going to happen, of my trajectory, which is ultimately good, you know. But yeah, I would say I lost the motivation to make movies was probably what happened, and the reward for doing creative work. And honestly, the most important thing was kind of starting my own production company, Squishy Studios, really just doing short films and 48-hour movies, like in 2005, 2007, of just slowly getting back and rediscovering, what do I love about this? You know, it was never about money. You know, it was about wanting to tell these stories, and that to be like my job, you know, my profession. That would be awesome. And it took, and I think the most healthy thing about doing Squishy Studios and doing the short films and doing the 48-hour movies and doing web series was that I was slowly starting to snowball and build crew members and build fans and honestly build my own voice, you know, because I look at both my first and second features. When I think of what my voice is now, they don't really reflect it that much. You know, the first one was kind of like, ooh, I know I do comedy, but I'll do drama that's serious. It'll be taken seriously, you know. And then my second feature, the $4,000 one called The Constant Epiphanies of Billy the Blood Donor, that was based off of a play that my brother had written. And I thought, it's fun. Let's make something. I'm in the mood to make something again. But it was really more his story than mine. And so doing all these different short films and my web series, that really kind of developed like, what are the stories that I like telling? What are the things from my voice, you know? And it turns out that it's, you know, it's kind of comedy that's outwardly very silly and ridiculous. It's, again, it's like strange things happening to normal people or normal things happening to strange people. But it's very much kind of, you know, that comedy, that genre comedy with a heart.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to kind of like take us a little bit back to the other questions just because I see a place. So, you know, you have this amazing journey of making all these movies and like, you know, the features that leading to the shorts. At what point did you decide that you wanted to make the last movie ever made? And like, how long did it take you to like from writing that script to now it being released? What was that time period like?
Yeah. So I think my strength as a filmmaker is just like, I'm too dumb to quit, like the tenacity. I'm not like a super like ambitious in terms of like, oh, I'm going to crush it. I'm going to finish the script by this month and I'm going to then write a TV pilot. Like, I'm just slowly tenacious, you know. The decision to write the last movie ever made, I think this was 2018. I was literally lying in bed in the morning realizing that my previous script that I'd been working on for 2 years was way too ambitious. It was just kind of like one of those come to Jesus moments where you're sitting there, it's never going to happen, you know. And it's insanely ambitious, and I thought I could pull it off. And so I was just kind of lying in bed, and it ended up being two ideas that kind of crashed into each other, which is, you know, it's like, you know, following someone who wanted to remake their old, who wanted to make their old movie from high school. And it's like, what is the motivation around that? Like, you know, someone who is doing something, you know, very ridiculous, very silly, very low stakes, but it's so high stakes for them and it has so much meaning for them. Like, that's interesting. And then the other idea, hopefully this isn't a spoiler for the movie because it's in the trailer, but the idea of like, how can you do a comedy about if everyone discovers reality as a simulation? So yeah, that's our world ending MacGuffin, is that in the first 2 minutes or 3 minutes of the movie, everyone learns that reality is a simulation. So that gave us a weird obstacle, but a unique approach to the end of the world thing. You know, you can kind of get rid of like everyone going post-apocalyptic and trashing cars and things like that, because you know, we've got like this Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy voice that appears in the movie. that basically says, oh yeah, we're just going to switch off your we're going to reduce your panic level. We're going to make sure the power stays on and you can just hang out with friends, you know? And so that's kind of our very weird framing for our story at the beginning of the movie, which I was really worried whether or not it was going to work or not. But we just made sure that we spent a lot of time in the first act with our characters and they felt very real and very normal and just leaning on that kind of realism. And so we're hopefully not asking our questions, well, why does this even matter if they don't technically exist, you know?
Well, because they exist to themselves,
exactly.
You know?
And I'm hoping, yeah. And we don't say if their reality is our reality, but we're kind of inferring that it is. You know,
yeah, yeah. It's interesting. There's a couple of times, so I watched most of the movie today and yesterday, but like it is a couple of times in the movie where you're like, why does that even matter? And then you're like, oh wait, because it is their world, so of course that stuff matters to them. Like, why wouldn't it matter? You know.
Yeah.
Anyways,
it's so hard when you're doing, because this is kind of like a comedy. I've sometimes described it as like a comedy Black Mirror, to where there's just one little thing change that kind of make ripples and makes everything different and weird, you know, and balancing such a global like world building concept on a micro budget. Like, we can't show like giant cities, you know, like New York and New Delhi and all these other cities around the world. Oh, Jesus, New Delhi called Mumbai now. And and then we can't like show the world or like the president reacting to this stuff. So we have to figure out how to give their world building where they have just the right amount of information that the characters would know from their point of view.
Well, just to kind of further Alric's question. So you wrote the script in 2018, or these ideas kind of crashed together around that time. And then for the next, what I'm assuming is 4 or 5 years, are you just polishing the script? Or are you fundraising? Or what is, I like your slow tenacity, but I'd be curious what the cadence is of like prepping for the film.
So I would love to say that COVID kept us from shooting production, but honestly, like, from 2018 to 2019, I was just kind of writing the script and workshopping it, doing additional drafts. And then from like 2019 to 2020, so for a full year before COVID, nothing happened with the movie. Ooh. So because our biggest obstacle was, well, okay, well, how do we fund this thing? How do we, you know, I didn't have, you know, I've been fortunate in doing all these projects and things to have a lot of crew members and a lot of actors. That was kind of like our troop of people, but we've never found like funding in a reliable way.
Who has, by the way? Yeah, I don't know anyone who has reliable funding. Yeah.
unless you're funding it yourself with your millions.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's reliable.
So it was the question of like, how can we, who do we know with money? Where is this going to come? And honestly, the whole project was on pause for about a year. And so then COVID happened and there was basically a year of COVID. And it just me realizing it's like, we got to do this ourselves. We have to do this ourselves. And so the whole movie is self-funded. It's funded between friends. So I'm a freelance writer and director. I do like corporate video and an occasional commercial. I also teach pre-production for film at Glendale Community College. So I'm primarily like a gig worker, and I was lucky enough to have one or two gigs come along pre-COVID, you know, that were kind of a little larger projects, you know, that were like, oh, we need 20 real estate videos. You know, and so I was starting to sock that money away and used a lot of that for the movie. And then the rest just came from not outside people who loved us, but inside people who loved us, like some of the crew members.
Are they equity, though? Like, did that money turn into equity?
Yes.
Stakes? Okay.
Yeah. So that money is, yeah. So they are officially investors. But basically what I did is I had a budget for what I thought we could make the movie for. It's like, this is the smallest amount that we can make this movie for. And so then I cut that in half. And then that's what we shot it for. And so we went into production with only the amount that we had to shoot the movie. But since I'm also an editor, I knew that we could basically have the movie finished with the exception of the music, with no money. You know, yeah, we had the advantage of really being able to post most of the movie in terms of just a couple of visual effects here, sound design, sound mixing, and all editing just with me. And then when it came to music, then we'd have to start spending money again. So that kind of gave us like a, you know, like about 9 months or so to kind of refill some of the coffers between production and post.
You took away one of my questions and asked, like, you know, over the years, like, what have you done to, you know, to provide for yourself? You said, oh, you do video production stuff and freelance, you know, shooting and editing and directing and everything. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the real question is, like, you know, after all those years of, you know, you had made two features and then, you know, you made all these shorts and web series and all these things. What drove you back to wanting to make another feature? Like, what was the reason, like, that now, after 10 years or so, that you were like, not even 10 years, more than 10 years, that you're ready to make your next feature? Like, what was what was the feeling there?
So, yeah, I really love long form storytelling. Like, I love shorts, and I really loved our web series Voyage Trekkers. We did two seasons of it, very much kind of like Galaxy Quest meets like Star Trek. You know, the world's worst starship crew in the galaxy, and loved doing the 20 episodes that we did for that. But just realizing that, like, the thing that I fell in love with was movies. You know, it was telling the greatest or worst experience of someone's life and developing those characters, like an ensemble of characters, and having like a catharsis at the end. You know, like, those are the things that inspired me growing up. And that was the stuff that I really kind of like responded to myself in doing, like being able to kind of build the storytelling and build the characters. Like, you've got to, you know, you've got to find that spark of the thing you love. Like, filmmaking is so ridiculously difficult in terms of the process. So much of it is frustrating or stressful or hard work. You have to kind of like find that thing that you really have, that kernel, that jewel of joy that you kind of go after, you know. And I just love that spark when the actors are coming alive and they're the characters, and you can see the moment developing, and you've got additional ideas there on set about what they can do, or maybe try this joke, and you see kind of like the material improving live in front of you. And then even in the edit room where it comes together and it starts, like, two different shots come together and there's suddenly an electricity, and it's like, oh man, this feels like a movie now. You know, that kind of joy of piecing together the little Legos and the story kind of happening, that's kind of like that spark for me. And realizing that that was more important than all the other things that made the process difficult. That was the kind of thing that would anchor me. I'd get excited about the next movie idea.
I'm curious about being an Arizona filmmaker. A motif that comes up in the show every now and then is like, do you move to LA? Do you move to New York? Do you move outside of there? Do you stay in your hometown crowd? Do you think that you could have made this movie with the cast and crew buy-in that you had you been in LA, or what are these benefits of being in Arizona for you?
Right. Yeah, it's that's a good question. So obviously my primary experience is just being a filmmaker in Arizona. I feel like it's possible to still do it in LA, because I know other filmmakers who have done something similar, you know. But I think we had the advantage of, you know, it's like filming outside of LA, you still have like these great locations and these opportunities, and people say, oh, it's exciting, it's a movie, and you get some stuff for free, you know. And there's no movie or TV production in Arizona, really, but there's still a lot of commercial production here, and so we still had craftspeople that we could draw on, so that was great. And just building up our troupe of actors and our crew over a decade and kind of building that repertoire, that was super valuable. And luckily, many of them have started to move away, but they were all game to come back for the project. And so we probably flew in about five people from our cast who had just moved to Minnesota or Nashville or even LA. And they were able to come back because they were a part of our other projects like 6 years ago. But yeah, I would say that there's definitely advantages and disadvantages. I would say the biggest advantages we have was probably location fee costs and you know, being able to kind of take advantage of some scenic difference, you know, of like the desert and things like that. I know a lot of movies that have filmed in Phoenix that try to keep the movie generic, and I wanted to really make it as Arizona-y as possible, just because it's normal to me, but I forget that some people see the desert as exotic. And so I wanted to kind of lean on that and make it like a part of the story. I think I answered 12 questions you didn't ask, but that's hopefully okay. They were of value.
I have to ask about a project on your IMDb that like is really interesting to me. It's Western X, which looks like it's a feature that you co-directed with two other directors.
Yeah.
tell me all about this, starring Vernon Wells, of all people. I don't know anything.
So that's one of those ones I don't count as a feature that I've done, because it was just a web series that got stitched into a feature.
It counts. I got four features.
I just got pulled onto that. And I was supposed to direct, there was like 10 episodes and I directed two. I don't even know if it's available anywhere. So that's why I don't put that one on my resume.
Still say it.
How did that come? Was that something that you were hired to do? Like, how did that come across? Like, you know, was this a project that like you were involved with like building up or tell us all the things.
Yeah. So my friend, Michael Flores, Western X is his brainchild. He wanted to do an epic sprawling VFX web series. So I got brought on. He wanted to have a couple of guest directors do a couple of the episodes. And I was brought on to do two of them. And then at some point, you know, it was then a feature, but I don't know if it was ever released. I saw some episodes and I was able to capture them online. But in terms of where anyone else can watch it, I don't think they can.
I want to talk a little bit about distribution, because I'm in awe of your calmness about everything in your life. And I'm curious if that calmness applies to your expectations and also the input of energy you're going to toss into the distribution release world. Wow. Can I just ask a question? I don't know. How much energy are you going to put into releasing this film? And like, what are your expectations and what's going on so far?
Okay. Micro budget movies are tough, because I mean, that's really all that we can kind of bootstrap. But the problem is that a lot of people don't watch micro budget movies. Yeah. You know, they'll see them at film festivals. That's a great opportunity. And then we as filmmakers will see micro budget movies, you know, as kind of part of our radius of the people that we want to learn more about or things we want to study and stuff like that. But yeah, it's tough. And I mean, independent film is so tough. And so it's, you know, I've equated it before. It's kind of like being an amateur wrestler or being in the minor league of baseball. Again, I'm using sports metaphors, apparently. That's my thing now. But like minor league baseball players make like somewhere between like $8,000 and $12,000. So that's not enough to be a sustainable income. And then you've got like these amateur wrestlers who have to drive themselves all over the country. And I'm sure some of them make a living doing it, selling like, you know, swag out of the back of their trunk, you know, homemade figurines and things like that. I kind of feel like micro budget filmmaking is kind of in that same category, to where I'm sure some people make a sustainable living from it, but it's so difficult to do so. And so I think any project that you go into, you have to decide what your priorities are in terms of it. I think the next movie, I have to be more fiscally responsible about earning our money back. But this one, which was self-funded, we had the freedom to not make our money back. If we made any money back, it would be awesome. The people who deferred their salaries would get something. I would love for that to happen, especially since I'm one of them. But yeah, I would love to pay a lot of the people who were some of the most dedicated and sacrificed the most on this project. But we did this really to tell a story, to move the needle forward, to be as like a calling card and to appear as a legitimate thing so we could make another movie. So we
a fifth movie, a 4.5.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there would be different things with this one and then the next one. But with this, we have the, you know, with that freedom that we don't need to make our money back. We made certain decisions. We decided to get a producer rep, reached out to Glenn Reynolds with Circus Road, because we didn't know the world of distribution. And we wanted to at least have one time at bat with being kind of guided through the process. And we found a small but really nice distributor that we liked. And to go through the process, and so that our, at least our movie has the appearance of legitimacy in the world for everyone who is involved, but also for potential investors and people who want to maybe support us for the next project. Mm-hmm. It's like, look, we made a real thing. It's out on real things. But I think that distribution strategy, it has to be a case by case basis. I think a lot of those things wouldn't be the case on the next one, because the next one we would probably try, you know, I'm broke at this point. And so it has to be someone else's money. And so then becomes the responsibility of making that money back. And so I think for the next one, we're going to have to go a much more traditional route of getting investors. And that means returning their money and making sure that we're responsible in that way. And so then, you know, it's like, so do we make the project more, quote, sellable, you know? And I don't know. I think I know what the next movie is going to be. It's definitely a little more genre, but it's because it wants to be, you know. I'm still going to make it weird. I can't help it. And so it's still going to be weird and silly and kind of going after that happy, sad energy. I think I've become, especially from screening last movie ever made in film festivals, I'm kind of addicted to making people both laugh and cry in the same movie.
I made people cry with my last film, and I get it. It was like a weird high. I was like, what? Like, you cried because of something? So yeah, I want to make people cry too. We are sadists, though, just so you know. Just so you're aware of what's going on here. It's sadism. Ulrich.
I'm into it.
Well, I'm just so has the movie been released yet, or is that still, do you have a release date coming up soon, or how far in the process are you with your distributor?
So we have pretty much we've turned over pretty much all of the deliverables. So we have a distributor, Good Deed Entertainment. And we've turned over almost all of the deliverables. I think at this point we just need to get the E&O insurance. And so we don't have an exact release date, but it's looking like it's going to be early summer, end of spring, that'll be out like on Amazon and iTunes.
Nice. That's awesome.
That'll be the beginning of the VOD window. And then I think the plan then is after that VOD window, it's probably going to go to AVOD, is my guess. Just kind of, you know, figuring out their typical strategy and stuff like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there still is a chance that you're going to make money back on this movie. So
yeah, that would be great.
You're sort of talking about it like it's already like, we don't need to, we don't worry about it, whatever. But like you did get distribution. You are going to go out into the market. Like, you are going to get some money back, you know, of some kind. So like, yeah, you should celebrate that. That's very exciting.
Yeah, I said, that would be so cool. Probably, it's especially since I could pay the people who worked on the movie. You're trying to like lower your own expectations, yeah, so you don't build yourself up too much.
Yeah,
I definitely am not anti-money. It turns out it's pretty useful in a couple of situations, but based on my like spending habits, you wouldn't think so, because it just all goes back into the movies.
That's funny.
It is time for our final six questions. So the first question is, what's the first film you ever made? We heard a little bit about it, but how do you feel about it now?
So, yeah, I guess technically my first film was when I was 11.
Okay.
But no, I'll talk about the feature. Yeah, so when I was 11, I did like a knockoff Indiana Jones movie. But yeah, no, for I guess Forever Midnight, when I was 22, I loved the experience. I loved the people involved. I cannot stand watching it because I will just destroy myself just in terms of like the choices and what I could have done differently. It's so strange that, you know, we've got like this critical eye to make the movie. It's like, oh, this needs to be better. Oh, this got to be better. And that you can't turn off that critical eye when you go back and look at some of your own stuff. Like I can go back and see some of the stuff that I did that was very silly and lighthearted. But if I was trying to like go for a big swing and if I felt like it didn't make it, then I'm much harder on myself for that. But yeah, no, I loved the experience, but oh, please don't make me watch it.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
I would say the best. So I'm going to cheat a little. It's not so much that I was given it one-to-one, but the best filmmaking advice that I've heard was from Jordan Peele, which is the movie you should make is your favorite movie that hasn't been made yet. It's like the thing, it's like, oh, I wish this thing existed. I wish there was something like this. You know, I would say that's a great attitude to have, is to make what you hope would have been your favorite movie had you not been a part of it. You know, I think ultimately for me as a filmmaker, that's one of my goals, is to make someone's favorite movie. And, you know, that's the hope, you know, besides outside of having a sustainable filmmaking career. If you can make someone's new favorite movie, then that to me is just joyous.
What's the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received or heard?
I would say it's the fantasy of that you make a feature film and then that golden elevator is going to appear for you. You know, some things can be successful. Some things are not successful, but it's the exception to the rule. I feel like everything that I've done, it's like climbing a staircase, you know, like doing a web series. That's a couple of steps. Doing a feature film, that's a couple more steps. You don't realize how far you've gone until a couple of years passed. You know, I think the fairy tale of if you make your first feature and then you're going to be magically let into Hollywood via this elevator, you know, I feel it's dangerous and it sets you up for the kind of, you know, disappointment that I had as a baby filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Boy, if I could do this for a living, that'd be great. I think the goal is to have a sustainable filmmaking career. You know, that would be great. I think it's always going to be a struggle. I think it's always going to be a difficult thing. And I think even the people that we put on a pedestal and think don't have a struggle are probably struggling all the time, you know. But yeah, I would say having a sustainable filmmaking career and making someone's new favorite movie.
I like that. If you could go back in time, what's the piece of advice you would give yourself?
Okay. So this is where people cheat and say, oh, if I time traveled, I'd change the past and then I wouldn't be who I was. Okay. So I would say if I could go back to younger me, I would say just be a little less afraid, you know, of going outside your bubble. Like I never applied to any of the big film schools because I assumed that I wouldn't get in. You know, there are collaborators that I never reached out to because I was afraid of rejection, you know. And so I would say it's okay to get rejection. Just be a little less afraid and be go outside your bubble. And I would say number two, if I get two things, is get back on the horse. You know, it took me a long time to kind of become a filmmaker after Forever Midnight, that first film. And it took me a long time to kind of get my confidence back again. And if I could have gotten back on the horse and just was making things, even if it was just for me, I think that would have done a lot.
Last question, is making movies hard?
Oh man, why does it have to be so hard? Yes, making movies is hard. Yes, it's not brain surgery, but come on. Yeah, I just feel like it's unnecessarily hard. You know, I think like, you know, like we say a lot, it's like there's no direct path. I wish there was. And you're really just kind of hacking through a dark jungle and, you know, and you can only see a few feet in front of you. And it's tough, especially when you get creative people with sensitive sensibilities, sense and sensibilities.
Yeah,
it's tough when you get creative people who have a lot of heart and are not very thick skinned to kind of have to hack and slash through that jungle. So yeah, it's tough. It's tough. But I guess at least we're not musicians. They've got it tougher.
Amazing. If people listen to this and they're like, man, I want to watch Nathan's movies. Oh my God, this Voyage, what's it called? Voyage Trekkers. Sounds great. Where should they go to check all that stuff out?
You know, so if they want to check out our short films, our web series, or stuff on the last movie ever made, the easiest route is just to go to squishystudios.com. If you type in the last movie ever made, you'll find us. But yeah, Squishy Studios, our production company website. It's got the links to the movie. It's got all the short films. It's got our web series. That's probably the easiest for everyone.
Liz, what do you remember about our chat with Nathan?
I just like him. I thought it was a great chat. I remember I met him through an event at IFP Phoenix. I know he's been associated with the podcast for a while, but I had never I was brought in via Zoom, but I'd never face-to-face talked to him. And I just think he's a wonderful resource. And you've seen his movie, but I have not. But it just seems like that's up my alley. I really want to watch his movie. It seems delightful. So just cool. A fan of Nathan's. What about you?
Well, it's funny. I went to Phoenix for my feature, The Alternate, and the day I went, he was not there because he had something going on that he couldn't be there that day. But he was there like the day before, and he was going to be there the next day, and he like moderated a panel and stuff, but he didn't moderate my panel for my Q&A for my movie, you know. So it was just like, it was funny. I feel like I was minutes away from him, like maybe, you know, like 20 minutes away from where he lives, and I didn't get to meet him. But we did talk on, you know, through Messenger and stuff. So, you know, it was cool. I got to hear about him making his movie when he was making it. And I think maybe he was shooting a scene for his movie or something. It was something like that. It was something where like there was a really good reason why he wasn't at the one film party that I got to go to in Phoenix. But anyways, yeah, I guess what I remember most about this conversation was watching his movie and digging it and just like the way that he like really just pulled it all together. You know, like he willed the movie into existence. All the props that he had to make for the movie, all the sets. It was like, it's a lot because it's a movie about making a movie. So it's like, not only do you have to like make the set for the movie that you're making, but you also have to like make the sets for the movie that they're making within the movie. And it's a sci-fi movie they're making in the movie. So it's like, I mean, it was just a lot of stuff, but it was very cool. And yeah, I just think it was a really interesting story. And I really wish him well. I hope the movie finds a big audience. It's a really fun little sci-fi, you know, art drama comedy movie that's got a lot of stuff pushed into it, which I think is always great. But what also is great, Liz, what do you got for us?
It's our next segment called Ask the Expert. Why is it so hard to say the phrase Ask the Expert? That should be an Ask the Expert segment, and I would put it on you, Ulrich, to answer it because I don't know.
I was just going to say that we've been calling it You're the Expert, but then somehow Ask the Expert got snuck into this copy here. So I think we're actually calling it You're the Expert.
We've been calling it Ask the Expert for a couple weeks, just so you know, because I listened to the show and last week it was Ask the Expert.
I just said You're the Expert. Okay, I gotta figure it out. We gotta get it right so it's always Ask the Expert, because I feel like, yeah, if that's what we're calling it, we should call it that.
Either way, I'm going to struggle through it. Like, whatever you call it, I'm going to screw it up somehow, and it's going to work for me. What is this segment? After all of this hullabaloo, let me tell you. So our producer, Eric Toms, has decided that we are experts enough to fill probably a 5 to 10 minute segment on our podcast about a certain topic that he thinks is interesting. And this week, producer Eric Toms set up this question for us to answer. Eric says, I'm gearing up for a low budget feature, which is set in modern time. I don't want to ask my actors to wear their personal clothes for the shoot, but I'm afraid hiring a wardrobe person may be too expensive. What are the pros/cons to hiring a wardrobe person, and under which circumstances do you find them invaluable? Ulrich, answer this question.
Yes. So I feel like for a feature, wardrobe is very important and kind of a must have, because there's so much continuity going on that you really want to have someone who's in control of all the outfits for the movie. Even if the actors are bringing a lot of their own clothes, which, you know, I mean, I feel I'm not like anti that. I feel like if they're down and they're willing, that would be really great, you know, but I think
especially for a feature, like there's so much in a script that's like maybe specific in their characters and who they are. And there's a lots of things where like maybe their clothes have to come off and maybe their clothes have to get bloody or whatever. And so I think like in those situations, it's really great to like just have the outfits be bought, you know, and then you're going to have multiple versions of those because you're going to need them for lots of reasons. But yeah, I feel like for a feature that's really important, for a short, I feel like it's less important. I mean, there might still be key things that you need. So like what I've had done before is like, maybe I've had a wardrobe person help me like get the key items that we need for the shoot, you know, and then like not even be there on the set day and just like have it all lined up for like, these are the outfits for each scene. And then just have the actors get in their own wardrobe, you know, which I think works totally fine. And then the makeup artist will like kind of help like make sure that they look good and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's kind of like a little adjustment thing. But yeah, I think for a feature, it's like, even if they are bringing their own clothes, because like it's the budget for wardrobe can be really, it gets out of hand really fast. So I think having it be a mix of bought and provided by actor is probably like a good mix, you know, as long as the actors are okay with that. But in this question, if the director is not okay with it or you're not okay with it, yeah, just you have to write in a lot more money in the budget for that to make sure that you have wardrobe for every scene. But there are places like Goodwill, you know, and like if it's not very ultra specific, you could probably get it for pretty reasonable, you know, budget. But Liz, what do you say to this question?
Yeah. I mean, I've worked on shoots where there's like shorts where there's no wardrobe person. I've worked on shorts and features where there are wardrobe people. I just want to acknowledge that you're not just paying for the expertise, you're paying for their wardrobe. Like they usually have a closet full of backup clothes that they've collected through their productions. So it's not just like their services, it's their actual tangible resources they could provide the shoot. And I'd say a solution is something that I've done that you kind of alluded to is that I paid a consultant to source things for me on Amazon, and they would just collect measurements and then tell me what size to get on Amazon, and I would buy it. And then we would send them to the actor, and the actor would take pictures with them with the costumes on, and we would okay the outfit all virtually. I also want to acknowledge that, like, I like to work with actors who aren't like stick thin and cookie cutter and like, you know, who like they're beautiful. I'm not saying anything negative about, I mean, like I just like working with different bodies. And like that's what a wardrobe or a costumer or a seamstress or a tailor, like all those figures understand how to wear flattering clothes for different body types. And when you don't have that, you lose that expertise and you end up looking really like unprofessional on screen, I think, especially if your actor doesn't like weigh 3 pounds. You know, you want them to look good and reflect the character. And I always find it's really exciting when you talk to a wardrobe person and they have all these ideas about clothing that have to do with the characters that you never even thought about. Like, oh, I really think they'd wear these boots, or I'd really think that, like, it's like a wonderful creative collaboration. So I think there are worlds where you can pay consultant fees if you don't want to bring them on set, and you could have a PA who has like a steamer who could steam the clothes and just help put the costumes on people. But I agree, like having a wardrobe person is super important. All of these, it's so funny. Eric's questions are always like, what should I spend money on? And it's like, well, it's really hard not to encourage people to spend money on these roles because it really does help make your project better to have a great wardrobe person.
I was curious, what is a con to hiring a wardrobe person besides budget? Is there a con? I don't really know.
I don't see it. No. The only con is money. No, but I don't like the idea of conflating it with too many other roles because I think that you really a lot about a character from what they wear.
Yeah. Have you ever done a feature without a wardrobe person?
No. On my first feature, I had an actress who was a plus size actress, and it was very difficult to source a costume for her. And my costumer, who is amazing, had never dealt with that before. So it's like that was really, I'm not saying there's a negative here or a positive here, but I'm just saying like it couldn't have been a last minute purchase for that individual, right?
Right, right.
So there has to be a lot of thought and care and time that a lot of people don't have on a low budget shoot. to be given to non-cookie cutter bodies. I don't know why I'm going into this. I'm tired. It's fine. We can cut it, Jeff.
I think it's valuable. I think it's good. Yeah, I just want to double down on what you said. I had a really wonderful experience with working with my wardrobe person on the alternate. The things they brought to the table based off of the script were awesome. And things I would never have thought of, things I would never have picked, things I didn't even know existed. It was like, it was just really, really cool. And so I was just really grateful to them for their picks, because it was some really cool stuff that's in the movie.
Yeah. Well, with that, you can always send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Make sure it gets populated. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. We wanted to shout out the International Screenwriters Association, which is an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through the programs they offer. Head on over to networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Nathan Blackwell for coming on the show. Thanks to editor Jeff Reimut for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. Thanks to our producer Eric Toms for being awesome. Most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.
QuickTime screwed you.
Yeah. Oh, but it's back now. QuickTime's back. Thanks, QuickTime.
Yeah. Thank you, QuickTime.